It's February 16th, 2018. I'm Justin Katz, and Last Impressions episode 44 is about the weaponized ridiculousness of political rhetoric. So the notion of ridiculousness in political rhetoric came at me from multiple directions this week. Probably the most personal and notable came when the Gaspy Project, which is a conservative group in Rhode Island with which I'm somewhat affiliated, they put out a meme of State Representative Aaron Regenberg, who's maybe the poster boy of Rhode Island progressivism right now. He put in legislation to essentially give the state authority to go after any public or private school on a very broad and vague array of discrimination investigations. And so the Gaspy Project put out this social media picture with the words on it, the meme of Aaron Regenberg, saying that he was a thought police overlord, or wanted to be a thought police overlord. And his fellow progressive from Providence, Senator Gail Golden, responded and included the Anti-Defamation League in her response, saying it was just an anti-Semitic dog whistle, which I found ridiculous. And looking at it, Overlord has no specifically anti-Semitic overtones. It's from feudal times, and I had a post on the Ocean State Current this week saying essentially that it's exactly accurate. And the only way you would see it as anti-Semitic is if you look at Regenberg as his photograph on this picture, and it jumps out at you that he's Jewish. And so I tweeted back that, hey, you know what they say about dog whistles, right? And her husband, Jeff Levi, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, kind of pulled me into it to get me to point out that if you're hearing a dog whistle, you're the dog. Now, we're completely in metaphorical realm here. And so that became a big thing, and it ended up with Aaron Regenberg essentially trying to take a moral posture, looping in a local journalist saying, stop calling people dogs, which is ridiculous. And it really makes you wonder, or makes me wonder, are they serious? I mean, are they really not seeing how this works, where you use a metaphor and then somebody responding to the metaphor says, well, in that scenario, you are this component of your metaphor. Do they really not see how that does not conflate with saying you are a dog, or attacking somebody as a dog? Do they not see it? Or is it just kind of cynical politics, try to make me uncomfortable, make other people uncomfortable associating with me, trying to generate some kind of smoke of scandal? I don't know. But the whole overlord concept is accurate. And it's not just this particular bill having to do with school discrimination. Another piece of legislation of Regenberg's I posted on the Ocean State Current this week has to do with, his entire fair, quote, fair shot agenda, which I call the headshot agenda, because it's like a shot in the head to Rhode Island's freedoms, to its economy. And his rhetoric around that in public when he was speaking about it was all about using government money, government power, to take money away from wealthier Rhode Islanders. So here's a direct quote from his presentation as reported in the Providence Journal. Just this year, big corporations and the wealthiest 1% used their influence to get an enormous tax handout from Republicans in Congress. In Rhode Island, we can use our power to tilt the scales back towards people who are dealing with real problems. Now, you can go to my post on the Current and I break that down in some detail to illustrate what's wrong with it. But the whole notion of taxation is that we agree freely, albeit through a system of representative democracy, to fund government at a certain level for services for all of us who we agree are necessary by that mechanism. The agreement in that equation is central. Otherwise, we do not have a consensual government. We have a dictatorship, an oligarchy, aristocracy, feudal society with overlords. So what's striking about this with the word power is that in Regensburg's view, when wealthy people win in this political process that's supposed to make our entire government, to bind us to the decisions of our government as an agreement. When people he doesn't like win in that process, it's illegitimate. They've used their influence, the unfair influence. But when the progressives take over somehow and use their locus of influence and power, they're going to use that power to take that money away from them. It's not their money. And that is a ridiculous notion. I went back and forth with a longtime commenter, progressive, who usually tries to comment just to get a rise out of me. His argumentation style is in bad faith and usually disingenuous. But it took forever for me to get him to say, people earn the money that people own the money that they earn. It's like that's some major concession for him. So that's the ridiculous view that they've got. We're going to use this power of government to take your money away. And it goes back to core principles. One of the clips that I built up, I mentioned in the last episode that I had built up a bunch of clips over a month or so two of not podcasting, was of David French talking on his podcast, The Liberty Files, which he does for National Review Online. And he was talking about the Democrats' rhetoric nationally after the Republicans and Donald Trump passed the increasingly popular tax reform bill. And the rhetoric was all, this is theft, it's looting, we're taking away from the poor to give to the rich. And this was French's thinking on that.
And I think we're moving towards part of the American left that really is looking at that what is yours is the array of government goods and services established by this really vast and growing federal bureaucracy. What is yours is the bundle of bureaucratic and regulatory rights created by a vast regulatory state. And that private property is really a public resource. Private businesses are really public accommodations. And so essentially we are resources for the state. And what's really only ours is what the state provides.
So the words, his word choices are important there. He's talking not only about the government's ability to take your tax, but with the public accommodations language, that comes up mostly with regard to freedom of conscience and freedom of religion arguments, where we say, you know, if you own a business, you shouldn't be forced to provide your services to honor, say, a same-sex marriage with which you agree or disagree. So in the view of the progressives, they own this. They own the business. You have to do, if you're going to be out in a public square, that is their domain. You do not own your actions there. You're there by their agreement to let you ply your trade in the public sphere. And the Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity has been pushing occupational licensing, and that's our opposition to occupational licensing or so onerous a regime of it. And that's a big part of it, is if you're going in the public square, we get to tell you what to do, what you can do, who you can do it with, how you do it, and so on and so forth. And what you can charge, what you have to pay your employees, all of that stuff. So that is what French is alluding to here, is this philosophical notion of the left that they own really all economic activity. And the overarching insinuation of that is almost more insidious. It's that government is sort of our means of helping each other. Government is our way of doing good deeds for each other. And that, so everything government does is a good deed. It's all altruistic. It's government service. We talk a lot in Rhode Island about how I've complained that the Ethics Commission, if two people in government do something together in a way that looks like it's biased and not fair and unethical, it doesn't matter because they're in government. There has to be a private sector component. So the lawyer in Tiverton can represent, the lawyer who works for the town council can represent the town clerk before the town council because they're all in government. They're just trying to do the right thing, right? It has nothing to do with the fact that this is all their livelihoods. No. It's very different. If they were all private sector people, that would be unethical. So that's this notion that government is the locus of goodness. Therefore, in a tax scenario, if you take money away from government, which is the way they think of it, if you don't give them your money, you're taking it away. And not only are you taking it away from government, you're taking it away from poor people and people who benefit from the services that government in its goodwill provides. You're not taking that money away from some oppressive bureaucracy with employees who make disproportionate incomes versus their private sector peers. No. That's not what you're not taking it away from them. You're taking it away from the most vulnerable people, and you're giving it to the rich. And that is ridiculous. And it gets to core philosophical differences that go to the freedom of religion debate. I'm a Catholic Christian, and that contributes to it, but I've always had this sort of sense that everything I do is and should be part of trying to make the world a better place, to help other people, to leave things better than they were when I found them. If that's the case, if your entire life is oriented in that way, you have a right to decide how you're going to do that. So you can't just say, you know what, I'm a baker, and that's just what I do from 9 to 5. So if I bake cakes celebrating immoral, what I consider to be immoral activities, you know, it's just my job. I leave it when I go home and turn on the TV or pray or whatever crazy thing I do when I go home. That's not the case. So what you're doing, even if you're not creating something artistic, and I'm kind of disappointed that the Supreme Court or the legal debate has gotten to the question of whether cake bakers are artists in some important sense. It doesn't matter. Whatever you do with your life is your art, is your means of charity. That should be, and for many of us is, the entire theme of our lives. So charity should not be just whatever, you know, whatever additional money or time or activity you're able to squeeze out of your life after you're done working for government and paying government its money. That's just a ridiculous point of view. So also on that episode of Liberty Files, David French's co-host, Alexandra De Sanctis, they were talking about, separately, a new issue, the Washington Post's House conservative, Jennifer Rubin, was under fire from other conservatives because she seemed to be, and she has seemed to be, really changing her positions on particular issues depending on how it reflects on Donald Trump. So any position that Donald Trump might take, even if she once agreed with that, now becomes, no, this is a horrible thing for him to do. And so that was David French and Alexandra De Sanctis were discussing that. And French was saying that he opposes, in a sense, conservatives joining with, quote, the resistance, the progressives who are insisting that Donald Trump is illegitimate and has to be opposed in every way. And one of the very Christian reasons that French was saying that was that, you know, universal opposition to Trump, and I think this is a direct quote, could encourage him to be worse. So we have kind of a duty to try to draw him however bad he may have been and continue to be in certain ways, especially personality and behavior wise, we want to draw him to his own salvation, of course, and also to making good decisions for us all. And Alexander de Sanctis took it in a little bit of a different way. And I think it's important to note this.
I think a huge piece lacking from the Rubin's view of Trump is that there's really no evidence that he's the second coming of Hitler. And, you know, of course, if he were, I would probably agree with him that, you know, I don't really care if Hitler's enacting pro-life laws, I'm not going to support Adolf Hitler, right? But I don't think that he is Hitler. And there's this kind of idea that he is or that he could be. And there's just no, over the last year, he's done very little of his own accord. He's done a lot of, you know, what he's done has been prompted largely by the people around him, or has been just kind of him having his hand here and there in what Congress has been trying to get done. But I haven't really seen anybody on the hysterical left or this sort of center-right coalition, this anti-Trump, never-Trump coalition, pointing at something that Trump's done that's so existentially threatening. And I can't even think of something that someone has mentioned to me as a possible example of this. Can you?
So the real important point here is that you can't abstract this. You can't just say, oh, he's just take on faith. Take on as assertion or a point of style that he is Hitler. And therefore, even when he does things you agree with, you must oppose him. If somebody is Hitler, you'll have evidence. You'll have things you can point to. And if that's the case, if you have concrete policies, concrete things that are Hitler-esque, you would have the space to say things like, well, this pro-life policy, for example, is good, but that cannot distract us from this over here Hitler-esque activity. When it's just, you know, he's Hitler, you can't associate with Hitler. Well, so what? You're supposed to abandon your pro-life views and that issue is off the table for now, for as long as this particular president is in power? That's what the ridiculous point of the progressives' push really is about. I mean, the left wields this, quote, fighting Hitler analogy first in order to, you know, make it uncomfortable to support a politician for wholly political reasons, to say, you know what, I don't like the guy, but I'm supporting him versus the opposition because he's representing my views on the policies of the day more than not. And the other reason the left is wielding this fighting Hitler analogy is, well, you know, on some level, they can we be frank here? They really believe that us ordinary conservatives are like Hitler. I mean, the activists, the organizers of the left may or may not, I guess, understand that it's all a ridiculous, rhetorical ploy. But, you know, many of those who follow them really do believe that doing things like letting people keep their money or asserting the right of an unborn child to live, they really do believe that these views are akin to imprisoning people and embarking on genocide. I mean, they can't be thinking about it too clearly, but that's got to be what they believe. Locally, it made me think of during this period of podcastlessness. This is kind of a burdensome circumlocution, but there it is. So during this period, another local issue that's related during this period of this month or two that I wasn't podcasting came when Rhode Island Senator Elaine Morgan brought some attention to a video that was shown, I guess, in an English class at the Cherokee Regional High School down there in the far south end of the state. And so apparently the topic of discussion had to do with the racist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. There may have been something having to do with the Holocaust. And the teacher showed a video, I think put out by the Atlantic Magazine, narrated by Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's a big identity politics writer. And this was pretty much the message of that video.
And when you ask yourself, why would majorities of white people across socioeconomic demographics, across gender lines, across education lines, endorse someone who only had whiteness to offer, and all you come to is tribalism? That's all that's left.
Now, politics aside, and whether it's appropriate for a teacher to be, which I think we can probably assume was the case here, imposing his or her view or bringing a political view into the classroom, probably with one-sided presentation, that's a problem. But the bigger problem, I think, of showing this in an English class arises if it wasn't presented as an example of what not to do. If this video was played in an English classroom, they better have been tearing it apart, because the logic on display in this thing is just an example of exactly how an argument should not be constructed. Coates essentially starts his argument after the important conclusion, and that's the important question that ought to be answered in any before this his point can even be made or considered reasonable, is, were there other reasons to vote for Donald Trump other than whiteness? And the whole video, it's on a chalk sketch done live on a blackboard, and the whiteness just dripping like blood all over Donald Trump. So it's pretty extreme in its imagery, but the real question is whiteness, is that all there is, as he says? Is that the only reason to have supported Donald Trump over the alternatives? If there's any other reason, then Coates' argument falls apart. It's ridiculous. But, that's the strategy of the left and all the topics I put together in this podcast, that comes up. So you deny fundamentally that taxation involves taking people's money away, which has an insinuation that if you're doing it justly, then they have a right. They have some process to voice themselves legitimately and say you're taking too much. Or to deny that an unborn child is a human being, and you can't, asserting that and coming to the conclusion that women do not have the right to kill that child, especially after months of development and especially without some real good justification. That's not oppression. It's not Hitlerianism to come to that conclusion, but the left denies it. It denies that the child is a human being. It denies that taxation is taking people's money. They simply deny that their political opposition could have any motivation at all, except the motivation that the left wants to ascribe to us. And they pick that one, racism, because they can't address actual arguments, because it shuts us up. It says this person's ideas aren't even worth considering, so move along, nothing to see here. In fact, if you look, you're probably a racist too. Because, their progressives' beliefs and policies are ridiculous. They're naive. They're like telling people they're calling somebody a dog when they say, hey, by your analogy, you're in the position of the dog. That's not, it's absurd. But before I let this one go, I grabbed that clip from Coates, and I brought this topic up because of this little piece, which is only really, I guess, tangentially related. But before I close out, I want to play it. On Tara Granahan's WPRO show, Senator Elaine Morgan was on there essentially saying this is what the controversy is about. And Superintendent Barry Ricci of the Charahoe Schools called in to take up the school side. And this one part, I think, is worth teasing out. Hold on one sec. Here it is.
And let's face it. Does this belong in an English class?
It could.
The teacher trying to get her political points across?
I don't think so. I don't believe that. No.
You don't think so?
No, I don't.
Where's the English lesson in that video?
Well, if you look at the Common Core standards, there are all kinds of standards about analyzing sources of information, and it was done, as I noted in my letter, it was done as a unit on Charlottesville. It was not connected to some of the things that are being alleged.
Did you catch that? It's aligned with Common Core. Now I've emailed Superintendent Ricci about that connection to see how closely it could be drawn, or if that was just sort of bureaucraties about it's aligned. No, it's aligned with the standard core, which goes to show if that's the case. Well, if that's not the case, I'd like to see what the standard is. If they're raising in the context of looking at Charlottesville as their topic, and they're looking at this as one way to construct a bad argument, that's one thing. There are other ways it could be connected through Common Core. I'm not down to the line familiar with Common Core, but if Common Core is almost a justification. There are standards for analyzing texts, and that was what we were doing. We were analyzing a text. That kind of shows the insidious motivation behind a federal standard for all schools across the country that has had a lot of people, especially particularly on the right, kind of nervous. Because what you do is you say, well, we have these standards, and then you introduce an offensive one-sided text and teach it as the important message. And then when people say, hey, wait a second, we're just doing this according to our standards. That's another way of dismissing opposition. Well, maybe that's not the way it should be done. So that's not an answer. When somebody says, how was this part of an English class discussion? The proper answer is, because this is bad argumentation leading to division and hatred and breaking down our society and making it impossible for us to communicate with each other. So we were analyzing this rhetoric, which was very mainstream. In the Atlantic, Coates is a mainstream, mainstream writer. And so we were analyzing it so our children will know how to spot this kind of fraud, this kind of dangerous fraud in our society as they grow up. But we know, come on, that's not how it was being presented. It was being presented as, at best, if there was another extreme, they say, see how this one does it this way and this one does it that way. I doubt it was even that. I think this was, here's an example of how Coates put his argument together. It was probably even more, here's how Coates catches the trick that this is aligned with Donald Trump. That's probably, and I don't know, if I had to pick from prior experience and what you read in the news in debates about education and politics, that would be my guess as to how that went down. But here you go, you turn it around and you say, I don't have to tell you how this particular item can be part of a lesson analyzing use of rhetoric in English. I don't have to tell you that because it's all to do with Common Core. And apart from whatever built-in biases Common Core had, that is a dangerous development too. And another way to dismiss legitimate concerns, you lock it up, you say, well, yeah, I see what you're saying, but we're operating by a standard. And if you're not arguing with us under that standard, well then, you'll have to go research that and come back to us when you're done. Well, anyway, so speaking of being done, that's it for episode 44. As always, leave comments, emails. I'd rather not get phone calls, but anything. You can go to voicemail on oceanstatecurrent.com, particularly, preferably in the post associated with this podcast. You can look for these podcasts on Ricochet. And if you're a member of Ricochet, go there and like the post, because then it bumps up how much they have to promote it. You can get these things through iTunes. So if you go there, don't just download it. Subscribe and also leave a 5-star review. And as always, we're We're looking for feedback, interaction. So if anything occurs to you, go ahead and do that and tell your friends that this is a, hey, at least there's somebody voicing some of these kind of ideas in Rhode Island. And, you know, even if it's not that great, it's worth encouraging to the extent of downloading and liking and all that kind of stuff. But in the meantime, don't forget that you shouldn't worry too much about first impressions because those can be fixed. It's the last impressions. They can dog you for an eternity. Have a good one.